Section 1, Introduction. Welcome to the second AAT podcast in the Employment Taxes series covering PAYE settlement agreements. Having covered the basics, including understanding what is a PSA, their purpose, how to apply, and what can or cannot be excluded, this podcast will look at what to do once we have set up a PSA. As I advised in discussing the basics of PSAs, it is best practice to set up and or renew a PSA before the start of the tax year, even though the final date for registration is the 6th of July after the end of the tax year, which relates to the taxable expenses and benefits to be included. Once we've set up our first PSA, we should be aiming to do this every year, remembering that PSAs are annual agreements and that they do have to be renewed every year, unlike a P11D dispensation, which is put in place and should remain valid until changes are made. Therefore, as we work through a timetable of events, we need to add the renewal of the PSA to our list of end-of-year PAYE and P11D checks, which I would be looking at in February each year. That is, of course, before the start of a new tax year. It will allow sufficient time before the end of the current tax year and before the start of the new tax year to do what we need to do. Section 2, record keeping. Having set up our PSA, we need to consider what records need to be kept to ensure that we can identify all the taxable costs to be included in the PSA in advance of preparing the PSA computations. The first step may be to set up some new nominal ledger codes for taxable PSA items. Perhaps separating staff entertaining and business entertaining costs if there is only one nominal ledger code at present, or if staff entertaining is currently being claimed through travel and subsistence nominal ledger codes, it would again be better to have a separate one for staff entertaining. It may be necessary then to issue new guidance to employees to explain what items and in what circumstances costs are to be posted to the new nominal ledger codes. Does there need to be a separate nominal ledger code for staff functions and or staff parties? Perhaps for annual events like the Christmas party or summer ball or barbecue, where we need to isolate the cost to determine which functions qualified for the tax exemption and can therefore be excluded from the PSA computations. Where are we posting other items, such as gifts or incentives? And do we need to create additional nominal ledger codes to separately identify, say, sales incentives from staff gifts? Staff gifts might include non-taxable items like modest Christmas gifts, the cost of birthday cards and minor birthday gifts that are not taxable. Where are the cost of flowers posted? Flowers given as a reward are taxable and should be included in a PSA. But flowers given to a sick employee or to celebrate a birthday or wedding can be excluded. Do we have clothing costs? Are some of these costs allowable uniform? Or are they ordinary clothing which has to be taxed, either by reporting on the P11D or, in this instance, by including in our PSA? Is there a black hole nominal ledger code or other items nominal ledger code that will need to be reviewed and that might be used for posting any doubtful items that we can review at a later date? I can assure you from my experience with clients that separate nominal ledger codes can save a lot of time and will reduce the number of queries to be reviewed. One example of this would be for a relocation, because when I hear from a client that there is to be a relocation, if there's not already a nominal ledger code in existence for relocations, I will advise that one is set up. It is much easier at the end of the year to be able to review and identify the costs. As well as keeping records to identify the costs to be included in the PSA, we also need to be able to identify the beneficiaries of the taxable expenses and or benefits that are to be included in that PSA. HMRC guidance tells us that where items can easily be attributed to individual employees or directors, the employer must retain the same records required for the purposes of completing forms P9D and P11Ds, and that we must record details of cash payments to individual employees. When we arrive at the stage of calculating the PSA liability, we will have to decide what tax rate to use. If a particular gift, incentive, or taxable cost can be identified as given to one director or employee, then we are required to apply the appropriate tax rate. For example, if we have Employee of the Year awards, we should be easily able to identify the recipients and then to determine if they are liable to income tax at the basic, higher, or additional rates of income tax, and thus allocate the costs accordingly. In contrast, if the taxable costs relate to a taxable staff function, such as a day at the races or a staff conference where there may be after-dinner bar bills that are taxable, we may not be able to easily identify who had what. Where it is impractical to allocate any item of cost between specific employees, a record of the individual concerned will not be appropriate. But we will need to determine what tax rate should apply to that group or groups of people. HMRC guidance tells us that the employer should record the following information. Firstly, the overall cost of providing the benefits concerned, for example, the total cost of providing a party which a number of employees attend. Then the number of employees concerned, and then representative samples of the tax rates of the employees involved. My advice is to ask the payroll person or department to provide a breakdown of the number of employees liable at either the basic, higher, or additional rates of tax. I will then prepare my calculations based on that breakdown for taxable items to be included in the PSA, such as staff entertaining and staff functions. However, for any specific expenses or benefits that can be identified as relating to individual directors or employees, I will include them in the PSA computations at the appropriate basic, higher, or additional rates of tax. We need to be aware that HMRC employer compliance officers will want to review our calculations at some time in the future, including our working papers, and we must ensure that we have the appropriate records in place to show them. I have never had a problem with any such review and have never had an employer compliance officer querying the lack of detail. Pay-as-you-earn regulations require that employers must keep records relating to PSAs for not less than 3 years after the end of the most recent tax year to which they relate, which is basically the same period required for keeping payroll and CIS records, i.e. 3 years after the end of the tax year. My advice to clients is that they should keep sufficient records to evidence the costs that have been included and the tax rates that have been used. Also to justify any items, such as the annual staff party or parties, minor or trivial items or exempt items that have then been excluded from the PSA. Typically, I will want to review an analysis of any Christmas party cost to ensure that all relevant costs, including VAT and any extras, have been included, and that there is evidence of the number of attendees, and therefore that the cost per head of any particular function or functions is within the £150 exemption limit. I have told AAT members many times that this £150 exemption is a limit, not an allowance. And if an annual staff function costs more than £150, the total cost, not just the excess over £150, must be included in the PSA. Similarly, if there are two or more such qualifying functions, but the total cost exceeds £150, the cost of any function that takes the total cost over £150 per head would have to be excluded from the exemption and included in the PSA. Simple example that I used on the P11D course, a £90 Christmas party and a £50 summer barbecue, total less than £150 would be exempt. If you added another party costing more than £10, the third party would have to be included in the PSA. Section 3, calculating the income tax and NIC's liability. HMRC guidance tells us that once your PSA has been authorized and you've received Form P626 from HMRC, your next step is to calculate the tax and NICs that will be due under the PSA. Reference is made to contacting HMRC's employer helpline, which I have to say I have never found necessary and would have the usual concerns about waiting to get a response and then wondering whether the person at the other end will be sufficiently trained to be able to answer my questions on PSAs. HMRC guidance refers to four steps involved in working out the total amount payable to HMRC under a PSA. First, you must calculate the total value, including VAT, of the expenses and benefits included in your PSA. Second, you must calculate the tax due on the items covered by the PSA. And we're told to note that the tax due will differ depending on how many employees pay tax at the basic rate and how many pay at the higher or additional rate of tax. Third, you must gross up this total tax figure. And again, we're told you will have to take into account year of whether employees pay tax at the basic, higher or additional rate. Finally, you must calculate Class 1B national insurance contributions as a fixed percentage, 12.8% for 2010-11, but now 13.8%. This will be a fixed percentage of the combined total of the value, including VAT, of all items in the PSA that attract a Class 1 or Class 1A NIC's liability, plus the gross up tax total from Step 2 above. Next, we're told that HMRC will finalise and confirm with you the total tax and NICs payable between 6th of July and 19th October. And the date by which payment must reach HMRC is 22nd of October if you pay by electronic means. To make sure HMRC can agree the amount due by the 19th or 22nd of October deadline, you should inform them of the value of the items included in your PSA at the earliest opportunity. HMRC points us to Form PSA1, which can be downloaded from the HMRC website, although it is likely to have been sent to the employer by the HMRC tax office when returning the signed P626 registration forms. The PSA1 is a calculation table where the first column is a list of the type of benefit or expense paid, followed by a number of columns from A to I to enter the total cost of the benefit or expense paid. Then three pairs of columns to deal with the tax band split for 20% basic rate, 40% higher rate, and the 50% additional rate of tax. Finally, we have the total tax column H and the total Class 1B NICs due column I. Like me, I assume that many of you will use an Excel spreadsheet, but if these calculations are new to you, the PSA1 table will be a useful guide to setting up your spreadsheet. Next, I want to talk you through a simple example of a PSA calculation, although you can also look at the HMRC example on the website page. Go to the employer blue box, click on expenses and benefits, then PSAs. My example is where the salesman of the year was awarded a £5,000 holiday that has to be taxed at his or her tax rate of, say, 40%. And there is also staff entertaining costs of £5,000 to be taxed at the average rate for the employees and directors who enjoy this function. Having registered PSA for taxable staff incentives and staff entertaining costs, and then using the PSA1 form, I will start with row 1 to enter the heading of staff incentive, put in £5,000 as the total cost in column A, and in column D, the value of benefit provided to 40% taxpayers. The same figure of £5,000 will be entered. In column E, I will enter the figure of £3,333.33, which is the £5,000 benefit taxed at 40%, giving tax due of £2,000, that has to be multiplied by 100 over 60 to achieve the grossing up at 40%. The total tax due of £333.33 is entered in column H, and in column I, the total Class 1B NICs is calculated as 12.8% for 2010-11 of the total of columns A, which is the £5,000 benefit, and H, which is the tax due of £3,333. In other words, £8,333 times 12.8%, which equals £1,066.62. Next, we enter in row 2 the heading of staff entertaining, and in column A, the total cost figure of £5,000. Let us assume that payroll have told me that 20% of the people on the payroll are higher rate taxpayers, and that 80% of them are basic rate taxpayers, so that in column B, we have to enter the cost figure of £4,000. In other words, 80% of £5,000. And in column C, the grossed-up tax figure of £1,000, which is arrived at by multiplying the cost of £4,000 by 20% tax, which is £800, and then grossing that by multiplying £800 times 100 over 80. In column D, we enter the figure of £1,000, which is the cost apportioned to higher rate taxpayers, in other words, 20% of the £5,000 total cost. In column C, we show the grossed up tax figure of £666.66. That is the cost of £1,000 times 40%, which equals £400, grossed up by 100 over 60 to arrive at £666.66. Next, we add the total tax figures from column C, £1,000, and column E, £666.66, to show the total tax due of £1,666.66 in row 2, column H. And in row 2, column I, the total Class 1B NICs is calculated as 12.8% for 2010-11 of the total of columns A, that is £5,000, and H, tax due of £1,666. In other words, £6,666 times 12.8%, which is £853.24 Class 1B NICs. Finally, we add up the totals from rows 1 and 2, giving us a total tax figure of £4,999.99 and a total Class 1B NICs figure of £1,919.86. This means that the total amount payable to HMRC by the 19th or 22nd of October deadline will be £6,919.85. I appreciate that it is not so easy to understand the computations when you cannot see the figures in front of you, but perhaps you could download a copy of the form PSA1 and complete the form next time you log on if you are unable to do this at the time you're listening to me now. Section 4, PSAs and statutory payments. Having referred you to HMRC's website guidance on PSAs, I will now read through the guidance on the possible effect of a PSA on employees' statutory payments. I have to say that I find this is rarely of any relevance, but it is perhaps still worth pointing it out to you. HMRC points out that in rare circumstances, having a PSA in place can affect an employee's entitlement to any of the five statutory payments. That is statutory sick pay, statutory maternity pay, ordinary statutory paternity pay, additional statutory paternity pay, and statutory adoption pay. This can occur if your PSA includes payments to the employee that would otherwise have been liable for Class 1 NICs. This is because their inclusion in the PSA, the payments will not count in the calculation of the employee's earnings. And this might cause the employee's earnings to fall below the level required to qualify for any of the statutory payments. In these circumstances, you must recalculate the employer's gross earnings to include the value of any payments that are included in your PSA and that would otherwise have been liable for Class 1 NICs. HMRC points out that further details are available in its four statutory payments help books, which are the E14, E15, E16 and E19. If you think you have an issue with this, I suggest you look at the help books as well as the revenues website. Section 5, PSA computation submission and payment. There is no statutory date for submitting the computation to HMRC, although the P626 form does provide for an agreed date, and that will normally be the 31st of August after the end of the tax year. I have sometimes seen it entered as the 6th of July after the end of the tax year, but I feel that's too soon, and I will always change that to at least the 31st of August. However, it is important to be aware that the payment of the grossed up income tax and Class 1B NICs has to be made by the 19th of October after the end of the tax year, or the 22nd of October when paid by an approved electronic payment method. The PSA computation should therefore be sent to HMRC as soon as possible, and at least by the end of August or early September. This is to allow sufficient time for the computations to be agreed and a payment reference to be issued by HMRC. I will always advise that a payment on account should be considered if the payment deadline is unlikely to be met. Failing to meet the deadline will result in the employer incurring an interest charge, and it is possible that HMRC will refuse to register a PSA for the future. The HMRC website tells us that there are special rules to follow when paying PSA tax and NICs. It warns that we should not use our normal PAY accounts office reference number, as the payment will credit to the wrong account, and this will undoubtedly cause delays in crediting your PSA account. I've had experience of this in practice myself, so I would urge you to make sure that you have a PSA reference to go on the back of your cheque or to go on the electronic payment. HMRC's guide, titled How to Make PAY Settlement Agreement Payments, explains what you must do. It says, HMRC recommends that you make all of your PSA payments electronically. HMRC counts all of the payment methods below as electronic, apart from payment by post. Paying electronically is safe and secure. It gives you better control over your money. It provides certainty about when your payment will reach them. It avoids postal costs and delays. It may lower your bank charges. It lets you pay at a convenient time if you use direct debit, internet, telephone banking, or debit or credit card over the internet. HMRC warns that you may be charged penalties if you do not make your PSA payment on time and in full. Your cleared payment must reach HMRC's bank account no later than the 22nd of October when paying electronically. Where the 22nd of October falls on a weekend or bank holiday, you must ensure that your payment arrives no later than the last bank working day before the 22nd of October. Bank working days are normally Monday to Friday, excluding bank holidays. If paying by post, your cheque payment must reach HMRC no later than the 19th of October. If you pay late, HMRC says that interest will be charged. There is also some guidance on paying by direct debit and using bill pay for paying by debit or credit card over the internet. Section 6, summary. In the two PSA podcasts, I've looked at the basics, the benefits and the mechanics of a PAY settlement agreement, how to obtain one, what can and cannot be included, and the main points on keeping records, perhaps setting up new nominal ledger accounts, reporting details, and making the appropriate payment to HMRC. I am often telling AAT members who attend the payroll year end and P11D CPD master courses that PSAs are not just for large employers, and that they can help small and medium-sized businesses to deal with taxable expense payments and benefits in kind that the employer does not want to report and does not want to meet. That the employer does not want to report and where the employer is prepared to meet the liability that arises. Remember my example about the director where the £1,000 staff party cost was put on his P11D and he paid the tax. The tax would have been less if the cost had been apportioned between the basic rate taxpayers and the director's 40% tax. HMRC regards PSAs, along with PLMD dispensations, as an essential part of their schemes to reduce paperwork. Personally, I think they may also help to dissuade HMRC employment compliance officers from carrying out employer inspections. This is because the risk assessment approach adopted now by HMRC employer compliance does mean that an employer who takes the trouble to deal with taxable expenses and benefits through a PSA is less likely to be seen as a risk of underpaying tax on NICs than an employer who does not have a PSA. I hope that you found the PSA podcast useful and wish you luck with them in the future. Thank you for listening.